This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. My name is Peter Higgins and you can find me at Conquest3 on Twitter. And I'm here with my good friend at Weedy Dealer on Twitter. And we're really thrilled. We've got a fantastic guest here for you guys and ladies and gents everywhere in the world listening to this podcast. We've got a guest. We've got the secret accountant. You can find him on Twitter at the secret ACCT. So welcome, Craig. How are you doing, fella?
Thank you very much. I'm really good, thank you, now that I've got off the M6.
Good lad.
What are you
good
doing man. On the M6? Well,
I spend my life on the M6, and if there was a mastermind subject for me, it would be the M6 between the junctions of 36 and 21A included.
Well, that's lucky, because I've got a load of questions on exactly
that. Yeah, we're going to we'll pose you a question on that later on. So, welcome back, everyone, and thank you once again for your fantastic feedback for podcast number 88, where it was just Wheelie and I freewheeling on the chat. But here we are with a guest. So I'm going to go straight into this today. We're going to talk briefly about the markets. Craig, feel free to join us, mate. Join in with this. We've had quite a continued bounce. We've had some flux over the past 2 weeks since we've been on air. But again, today we've moved up and we touched on the FTSE 100. This is Wednesday, the 30th of November, and it's 6:15. So the FTSE's shut, okay? The FTSE closed at 7,573, up 61 points. It touched 7,599. So we're right up there, right? This is, you know, territory which some people thought we'd never see, including myself, when we were having the LDI debacle and everyone said there's a Lehman moment just hours away and we're sitting nearer to 6,800. The FTSE had a bit of a wobble. FTSE 250 had a bit of a wobble today because quite a few fallers that were larger caps in the FTSE 250 got hit, including Home REIT, which I'll speak about later. That was down 9%. Synthoma, Aberdeen, Future and Darktrace were all down between 5 and 4%. So that knocked the FTSE 250 down a little bit, just 22 points down, 0.12%. The FTSE All Share finished up overall, up 0.67%. 4,139. The FTSE AIM All Share had a good day as well, up 0.5% at 848 points. So overall, the markets are still having that, as I keep calling it, someone will tell me I'm wrong eventually, a bear market rally. That's the way I see it. We're still in the grips of a bear, I think, regarding the markets. But tomorrow, well, we're almost in December, and Wheelie always gives out all the goodies and makes sacrifices for the Santa rally. So we may or may not get it this year, but he'll be praying for it. Craig, what do you think of the markets, mate, at the minute?
Well, they've been choppy for a while now, haven't they? And, you know, people have used the unprecedented word for the last 3 years about what we've been through with COVID. And I mean, I never have any idea. And I've got even a little idea now because who knows what's around the corner. And I should be called a boring accountant, really. Just stay invested and just ride the waves. And as long as you don't need to sell, just see it out. As long as you're invested in big, decent companies. I mean, it scares me to death if I was to have a small portfolio concentrated in certain AIM companies. I'd be frightened to death because you never know what's around the corner with those companies. But in terms of the market goes up and down. And to the extent it goes down, it'll go. It's a bit like cycling. I mean, I like cycling. And the worst thing about going downhill is you know you're going to have to go uphill eventually. So when the markets are going downhill, I think, well, they might carry on going downhill a bit, but they can't go all the way down. They've got to go up eventually.
I think that's true.
Point. Thank you.
Peter, I think mean reversion in markets and in stocks generally is actually a lot more powerful than people realise, I think. And a lot of these historic trends like the one I go on about, you know, the seasonal investing one, where, you know, you nearly always have a sell-off around September, October. Yeah, we got that. You nearly always have a rally, certainly in December. December tends to be the best month. November tends to be okay. We've certainly had an okay November. We're right at the tail end now. You know, and you usually get a sell-off in March, April. And it's incredible that it's almost like, even if you're in a bear market, if you're in a bull market, whatever, you still get these same kind of trends repeating year after year. And it's remarkable how powerful they are. And that's exactly what we've seen here. And I mean, it amazes me that the FTSE 100 is nearly at its 1 year high. And it would not surprise me one bit if maybe we consolidate a bit in the first few days of December. And by that, I mean, maybe a small pullback or a bit of sideways. But it really wouldn't surprise me if we actually break above the 1 year high on a FTSE 100 later in December. Would not be a shock. I mean, no one knows. You know, we may not get a Santa rally, but so often we do.
Yeah. There's a lot of uncertainty already priced in, I think. I think it's been overdone, personally. But I'm an eternal optimist, of course. You know, I'm a bull, fully invested, just expect everything to go up and to the right eventually, and it doesn't matter what happens in the meantime.
I think
now, before Pete, just one sec.
Yeah,
I want to get into this because we're talking a lot, but I've not really introduced Craig to anybody yet, so I just wanted to do that before we carry on.
Yeah,
and just hold that question, all that thought. Right, so Craig, you're on Twitter. We know you via Twitter, yeah, and you're on Twitter as a secret accountant at the secret ACCT on the accounts on Twitter there. But just share a little bit about yourself, what you want to share to introduce yourself to our listeners. And there's a little bit in there as well that I want you to touch on, because you did write a little book about accounting somewhere a little while back as well. So just touch on a little bit. Just give him a flavour of who the secret accountant is and where he's been and what he's done.
Yeah, no, thanks, Pete. I mean, thanks for the invite to coming on the show. I do think it's the best podcast that I listen to about finance. There's one
now, mate. That's good.
There's one that I like better, but it's about football. But apart from finance, which is the best one.
We can start doing football.
So my background is, you know, an accountant. I drifted into helping people buy and sell companies, in particular selling small family businesses, some bigger businesses as well. And then 10 years ago, I got into private equity, which is a glorified name for investing funds into private businesses. And my specialism, I guess, is investing in small family businesses. And I was listening to a podcast by Rob Moore. Rob Moore was saying, look, to make money, you've really got to find your niche and think what you're good at. And he said something like, I only invest in Rolex watches of a certain type between 1983 and 1987. It's got to be really nice. Anything outside that, I don't know the value, but within that. And he talked about Ferraris as well, a certain Ferrari between these dates, anything else. And I thought, what do I know about? I know a bit about football, know a bit about cricket, know a bit about drinking, don't really know much else. But actually, what do I know about? I know about small family businesses, investing in small family businesses, which is actually my day job. And I thought, why not just, people talk about all these side hustles. Well, actually, if you know what you're doing day to day, why not just focus on that and become better at that? And that's what we've done. So my day job now is running with a couple of colleagues. It's a bit like a private investment trust where we've got the majority stake in six private businesses. And our aim is to treble it in size in 7 or 8 years. And that's the plan. We look at about 1,000 businesses a year. And it's a bit like, I don't know if anybody's been on Tinder, but it's a bit like, no, 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 no. Ah, yeah, I like that one. So I send off for the information memorandum. We'll have a Teams call these days. Then we'll have a meeting. And then of those 1,000 companies we look at every year, we'll invest in one. So that show, and we've spent a long time working out what we don't like and things, you know, not going to plan, to what we really, really like now. And it's easy to, it's easy to spot what we like. So that's my day job. And you know, I've probably got about a third of my sort of investment wealth in that company. The other third is broadly in an AIM listed PLC that I used to work for, and now I'm a strategic advisor to find them acquisitions. And the other third is in my SIP and ISA that I self-manage. But I only started doing that about, I consolidated all my little tiny pensions in 2018 and started managing it. And like everyone, you start off, you get a job. You years ago, you used to buy a house and get a mortgage. You'd have get married, have kids. So you'd have no money. So it's only later in life that you're able to start investing. So we started doing, I think they were called PEPs at the time. Started doing, putting a bit of money in PEPs. Didn't value pensions because I thought, I'm not that old, so why do I need a pension? But did the minimum amount in company pensions, and then started putting more money into ISAs, and then I realised you got tax relief in a SIP when I got a bit older, and then consolidated them in 2018 and started managing them. And that, you know, that's what I do as a sort of hobby.
Craig, how easy is it to consolidate pensions that you've got from previous employment? Is it, you know, is it straightforward or is it a pain in the ass? What's it like? I'm sure a lot of listeners have got the same issue. I'm absolutely certain of it.
It's easier these days. I'm just doing it with my wife's actually. She had a small contribution scheme at a company that closed and they've set another one up. So literally you just send the form off to you set a SIP up online with one of the platforms. Yeah. So I've got a SIP and an ISA and a trading account with IIs. My wife's is with AJ Bell. I've got my son's with Hargreaves Lansdowne. That's only because I can check them all on my app without changing the usernames. But literally you send off a form and they do it all. And that's it. So they're contribution schemes. What is really difficult though is to transfer a defined benefit scheme, of course. It's over 30,000. Because I've got a small defined benefit scheme that's over 30,000 that I can't get an advisor to advise me to put it into my SIP because they said, you know, the advice is just leave it. Because if you put it in your SIP, you'll just lose it all. Well,
I guess with interest rates higher, you might actually be best off leaving it as a thing, because it's when they're lower, you get a bigger payout if you do opt out of the final salary pension scheme.
Yeah,
so that's not right. Pension advisors, let's just make that clear.
No, you're right, actually, because you can get one free valuation a year, I think. So I got one in 2019, and I got one in 2021. And it wasn't great, but it was okay. But I've not bothered getting one at the moment for that very reason, because I know it'll have gone down, so I may as well leave it. But the advantage of putting it in your SIP is that it's part of your estate if you die. Whereas if you start drawing it as a pension, if you start drawing, again, I'm no pension advisor, but this is what I understand.
Yeah.
If I can draw mine when I'm 65, but the moment I start drawing it, if I die when I'm 66, the pension's lost.
Mm.
So I'd rather have it in my SIP. I may make a hash of investing it, but at least it's there to pass on.
Well, it was when you started.
Yeah.
Craig, I want to get back to the investing side of it. I want to know for our listeners, because I'm looking at you and looking at Pete, looking, you know, three of us. I'm going to guess that we're around similar sort of age. And, you know,
40, yeah.
40, but, oh. Not, but below 60 between us, the three of us. We're in that middling bracket, okay? Some of us have got hair and, you know, you're blessed with hair and the other two haven't got any hair. So, when did you start investing and what was the interest back when you started investing, mate?
Well, I was four. I mean, my dad died at 13, which wasn't great, but my mum brought me a book. She used to run her own shop and she was quite entrepreneurial. And she started buying all the privatisations in the 80s, you know, like British Gas, Sid and all that stuff. Free Serve. And I think I did a couple of those with like 100 quid or something like that. But the main one, she used to look on Teletext at share prices, and I did as well. So I was 15, 16.
Good old Teletext.
And I noticed there was a share that kept going up and down between 3p and 5p, and it was called Common Brothers Shipping. And I had no idea what it did, apart from it probably had something to do with shipping. But I noticed it went up from 3p to 5p and then back down. So my simple logic, and I use this logic now, buy when it's 3p, wait for it to be 5p and take a profit. So the share price fell to 3p. I put like £100 in and it went up to 5p. And I thought, well, I'm Gordon Gecko. It was before Gordon Gecko. I am the future Gordon Gecko. Anyway, it went up to 15p. So
wow.
I made a few £100. And I'm thinking, this is fantastic. I sold. And that was my first lesson. Don't randomly sell. It went on to be 45p. And then years later, literally last year, I was reading an article about a guy.
Craig, so wait one, Pete. Go on.
I was reading about a guy from, so I'm from Preston. This guy's from Preston. Preston's quite a small place, and you tend to know famous people who've done well. Never heard of him. And I was reading his Wikipedia page, and he's some hedge fund manager. I can't even remember his name. He's worth about £1 billion. Again, it's strange. You normally know of people. His first share that he bought was Common Brothers Shipping. It's weird.
You've got the secret hedge fund manager. Billionaire.
But he probably sold 45p. That was the difference, and then went on to invest into something else.
Yeah.
So, brilliant. Craig, what was the lesson from that then? You know, is it that one of banking your profit or selling half?
Well, to be, when I said it was a lesson learned, with hindsight, it's easy to say I should have kept it to get to 45 pence. Who knew that it was going to go to 45 pence? I don't know why, whether it was taken over, because obviously I didn't have that information. But really, I should have taken the lesson about taking a profit, because that's what I didn't do with all those bloody AIM COVID stocks during COVID, mm-hmm. where I bought them all on rumors on Twitter, and a lot of them doubled and went, five bagged, and I just kept them, and now I'm sat on a loss on most of them. Now, luckily, it was just things around the edges, and it was something to do during COVID. But the lesson should be, never be afraid to take a profit and regret, keeping something, not keeping something.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, I always think sell half or sell a third of what you've got once you start getting a bit edgy. As soon as you feel like you want to sell something just to take that edginess away from you. Or you'll sell the whole lot and regret it,
I think that's right. I had Scottish Mortgage, and I've made quite a bit on Scottish Mortgage over the years. And in November, I actually sold a third and put it into some wealth preservation trusts and FTSE 100s, which have done well. So it was a great decision. Now, with hindsight, I wish I'd sold a lot, but life's not like that, because you don't know what's around the corner. But just coming back to my day job, the reason why we run a company, we used to run a 10-year private equity fund where we'd have to invest the money, do something to the company, make a gain and give it back to the shareholders. And we realized that the world doesn't work in 10-year cycles. So we thought we'll incorporate it. And the reason why we did that, we invested in a small business. We invested at a price of 3.6 million. And within 4 years, we sold it for 15 million. Again, we were thinking we were Gordon Gekko. Fantastic. Our investors loved us. 2 years later, they sold it again for 45 million. But the lesson there was, don't be a forced seller. Because our fund was coming to an end. We co-invested with another fund. They wanted to sell. We thought about going again. And anyway, now we don't have to do that. We can keep companies as long as we want. And that's the benefit we have as a private investor. The big benefit we have as a private investor, obviously, fund managers have loads of access to loads of information and analysts. I was listening to Stephen Yu being interviewed. I think it was on your Southeast one, Pete.
Yeah, and he was saying the Investing Matters one with Blue Whale. Yeah.
And he was saying most fund managers have 100 companies or 1,000 companies in their fund. How on earth can they research them? And he said they only have 25. And he went through the numbers, and he was saying each analyst looks after 5 and spends 10 hours a week or something on each one. And that's really, really powerful. So they've got an advantage over us in that. But the advantage we've got is, as a private investor, as long as you don't need the cash, we don't have to hug an index, or we don't have to beat a benchmark. We can please ourselves what we do, good or bad. We wish we would have sold, we wish we would have bought, but we don't have to do anything. And sometimes doing nothing is the best thing to do.
Because often one of the problems that funds have is when the people who invested into the funds want to get their money out, and it forces the fund managers to sell something they probably shouldn't be selling. And I think it applies for us as well. I think particularly for people who have to sell shares to get income to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you can get into a situation where you're thinking, sugar, I've got a big insurance bill I've got to pay or whatever it is. And you're thinking, damn, I'm going to have to sell something. You really don't want to get in that position. You've got to think ahead and think, well, 3-4 months down the line, I'm going to have that insurance bill. I need to make sure I'm selling something at the right time, but keeping that as cash so I'm ready to pay my bill, you know, and it's,
Yeah, you've got to have rainy day money. When people say, you know, how invested are you? What proportion have you got in cash? Now I say, well, zero, it's all invested. And you say, wow, but that's without, I've got rainy day money as well, because I don't go into, that's why I'm happy being fully invested, because I don't want having spare cash being a drag on returns. Although, you know, sitting in cash this year might have been a better idea, apart from inflation eating away at it.
That's pretty much the approach I take.
I wanted to ask you about your thinking back in November last year regarding Scottish Mortgage SMT, regarding the timing, on what you were thinking at the time. Were you thinking, you know what, this has come a long way, therefore that's the reason I'm trimming it? Or were you looking at other things that were going on in the market and thinking this is a bit overcooked? Is there any reason why you did it then? Because it was obviously timely, and now you're thinking you would have sold more. But
it was a rare thing for me to do, because what I don't like doing is hopping from one sector to another and being on the tail end, going from REITs to oils to this, that, to value to what, and coming all the way back. So I'd rather stay in. But I just felt, and part of it was listening to people on Twitter. You know, if a lot of people are saying the same thing, and I like to be a contrarian, but if a lot of people are saying the same thing, you've got to sit up and think, well, you know, they're probably on something. It did feel a bit toppy. So again, you know, if I could call the markets, I would have sold a lot, but I didn't. I just sold a third, and I'm glad I did that. And it just felt, I mean, I'm very simple. You know, they say the best decorators have the worst decorated houses. When we invest any money in one of our private companies, we do due diligence for months and months. We do every type of due diligence you can think of. We spend hours with the management team, really understanding the plans. When I'm investing in a public company, I just literally look at the share price and think, is it higher or lower than it was over the last 12 months? And what's the market reaction? And that's why I sold SMT. And this year, well, back in 2020, and again this year, I've bought a few FTSE 100s, because the massive companies and the dividend yields were so high and the share prices were so low. I didn't look at the fundamentals at all. I just thought, yes, you could have an RBS moment. One of them could go bust, but the chances are they're not. Now, I wouldn't do that with AIM stocks, because you've got to look at whether they do have any cash and what the revenues are and the profits and stuff like that and the prospects. But people, you know, companies like Lloyds, HS, you know, the banks, Aviva, Shell, BP, all those kind of things, they're just massive cash cows. And I just thought it'd be difficult to catch a real cold off them. So that's why I rotated. And somebody put on Twitter today that they were going to take profits and put it into a FTSE 100 fund. And I think that's a good idea. And I might do the same thing, actually, because I'm not a stock picker at all.
I think the interesting thing you said there, and also before that, was back during the COVID moments and lockdown, you were listening to what everyone else was saying. And the contrary to that is that you were listening to what everyone was saying regarding SMT, and then decided, too much noise here. So I'm going to go counter to that and take some off the table. And I think that's the lesson that a lot of people needed to have learned. I think once you're invested in the stock, a lot of people, including myself historically, we get rose tinted regarding the prospects regarding that particular fund or that particular stock. And actually what we need to do is remain objective as much as we possibly can and not get carried away, because once we get carried away, the share price will go beyond where it's meant to come back. And as Pete keeps talking about, it reverses back to mean, you know, and it comes back down again. And we're going, oh my gosh, I wish I'd sold that, or I wish I'd trimmed it, or whatever. And sometimes the speed of which it's gone up is far quicker coming down. And we're back to where we started sometimes with the share price. And we're thinking, well, you know what? It was a tenner not so long ago. It's five quid now. It's bound to go back to a tenner as quickly. Yeah. But it doesn't, because the momentum's gone and the buyers have gone, and it could sit here at fiver for a long time. Or it comes out with some bad news, as what's happened with quite a few stocks of late, you know.
Yeah.
And £10 becomes a long memory.
It is. I mean, there's that famous sort of graph that's going around Twitter about the share price of Berkshire Hathaway and is it Ark Innovations or Ark anyway?
Ark,
Wood,
And they both ended up at the same place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Craig, what's your view on diversification as a thing? Because some of the things you've said have made me wonder if you tend to stick to just a few stocks or if you've got more stocks, and do you diversify across sectors or whatever?
Yeah, I've got diversification upon diversification. I've always wanted to, in life, kept my options open about everything, apart from going too narrow from a risk point of view. So my SIP is full of investment trusts. The only fund I own is Fund Smith, and that's actually my ISA, but that's just what I put it into. I got caught out with Woodford. When I say I got caught out, I think I made a big gain, and then by the time it went bust, I probably got most of my money back. So it wasn't the end of the world for me. But that taught me about the issue with funds that you alluded to, Pete, about liquidity, and if people want to pull the money out, it you know, it's like a run on Northern Rock. I don't use a wealth advisor, so you know, I know what I'm doing, investing in small private companies. Listed companies, you know, it's a bit like being a GP. I'll probably have a good idea how to do brain surgery compared to a non-GP, but I shouldn't go anywhere near. Yeah, so I, instead of having a wealth advisor who says, what risk are you a 4, 6, or 7, and put it in this portfolio, I use investment trust managers to manage my money effectively, but I've got far too many of them. I must have about 20 of them, and really I should have about 5 of them. And what I do like at the moment, I try to be quite consistent. I like big global income generating stocks. That's what I like at the moment. I've done the growth bit with SMT, and you know, I'm still in profit on that. But if you had to pick a sector, I'd say big global growth. Well, a combination actually. So some private equity investment trusts I've got. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you got to be careful with which one you get. So there's a few in each one. And I've got a couple of EFTs and investment trusts, but it's mainly global. Some FTSE 100s, but not FTSE 250s. I used to have an HSBC FTSE tracker for years. Nothing wrong with that, and perhaps I should have some of that, but I just like big companies because the lower risk. I think it's an age thing, really.
Okay. Oh, do you know about one of your private equity holdings that you've got? Because there's quite a few out there. Some of them have done really well over the years.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think they've come off the boil at the minute. So what do you hold as private equity?
I've got 3i, albeit I'm a bit nervous. I've always been nervous of that because half of it's in some European supermarket, but it seems to have done well. I've got HG Capital that's done really well over the years.
Yeah.
I recently bought Oakley this year, and that's done comparatively well.
We mentioned that back in, someone only talked about that this week. Henry was talking about it this week, and we mentioned it. January 21, when it was £2.92, and it was £4.25 yesterday or the day before.
Right,
so yeah. It's done extremely well. It's been solid, and I think it could go higher. The bizarre thing is, despite it going from £2.92 to £4.25, it's still 34% discount to NAV. I didn't buy it. I don't think Pete did.
Yeah.
it's still going strong.
Okay. Pantheon as well. And a couple of others, and I can't remember the names, to be honest. But the other fund or investment trust that springs to mind that I haven't bought that I do like is, it's changed its name actually. It used to be BMO, and they had an income one and a capital one, and that's run by, I can't remember his name now. But again, it's got a good cross section. It's like a multi-asset fund, but within an investment trust. So I quite like that. Okay. And I like the Wealth Preservation Trust as well, like Capital Gearing, Ruffer, and RIT, and Personal Assets as well. And in the past, it's funny actually, in 2018, when I started managing it, to 2020, I didn't really like them. They haven't grown very much, but of course, we're in a massive bull market then. But they're coming into their own now. But I think it's about having a blend. And if you've got a diversified blend, I think you can afford to be fully invested all the time, although that's my view.
One thing that concerns me about you having 20, and you said, you'd like to get it down to 5, is that there's obviously going to be some overlap somewhere regarding that. So you could at least halve it if you wanted to. But I think the beauty of being in a bull market is when you're concentrated, you benefit from the bull market. However, on the downside, when you're concentrated and the market's declining, you get absolutely hammered if one or two of them go wrong. So you've got people now that are in the markets with 5, 10 stocks or funds. And because the market's was up until a month ago being hammered. Year to date, they'd been spanked.
Yeah.
You know, so diversification works in the cycles, you know, depending on what you've got. And in bull markets, obviously, you know, you've got to be careful.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
But you were saying that you had sort of changed recently and you said it was probably age. Is it also your sort of sense about the economy and the outlook for things, or has that played into it much?
A bit of a few things, really. I think it's, you know, the more and more you look at Scottish mortgage portfolio and a lot of these a lot of the IPOs that have gone wrong that were built on not hot air, but I just think I'd rather invest in businesses that have got real substance and longevity. I've set a SIP up for my wife, actually, and I mean, it's one thing losing my money, but if I lost her, she would actually kill me. So I've chosen a load of REITs for her. Because the yield well and they're asset backed, like supermarket, and it's come off a bit actually. As soon as I bought it, that's the other thing. That's the other mantra I live to, is people say, you know, what do you think affects share prices? I think it's Sod's law. The moment you buy something, it goes down. But as long as it's fundamentally a good stock, it should be okay in the long term. So I quite like REITs, and also bought her some. I say I bought her, it's her money. Some global sort of income generating ETFs, equity ETFs. I don't like bonds. I don't really understand them. I understand they pay a yield, but then the price goes up and down, which I get why it happens, but I don't really like it. Whereas at least with equities, you expect the share price to go up and down because of the profits. And it might have a yield, and the yield might, the yield will go up and down, but it should be fairly constant.
What's your like activity level? Because you sort of do a similar thing in your sort of working life. So are you sort of a bit of a mindset that you really don't want to be doing with it when it comes to your personal life? So funds and big companies mean that to a large extent you can be hands off. Because that's something I love about my income portfolios. I just basically leave it alone. And that's one of the rules of stocks I buy for my income portfolio. Yeah. Just leave it alone.
It's not that I haven't got time, and it's not that I don't want to do it because of my day job. It's that I genuinely don't think I can beat the market. So I may as well just use investment trust managers. I genuinely don't think I can do it. That's the simple reason. Because, in a way, it's a sort of perfect market, isn't it? The share price is driven by demand and supply. The information's all out there. So why should I have an advantage over anyone else? That's what I don't. You know, you see people on Twitter saying, I've analysed all these accounts and there's this, that and the other, and I think it's undervalued or overvalued. And da-da-da. I think, well, why are you right? Why is the market valuing? And there will be the odd one, but there can't be. I mean, generally, share prices are probably fairly priced. When they're not, I think it's because of the market overselling, as you said before, Pete. It's because of either contagion or people need to sell for liquidity reasons. So when there might be some specific reasons as well, but sometimes a share price might be oversold because of market conditions, and that's where I think there's some opportunities. But if a share price reduces because of something specific, the market's probably right, I think.
So Craig, tell us, is there any sectors or areas that you completely go, I am not going there? Is there anything, regardless of noise on Twitter, that you go, I don't care what they're saying, I'm not going there?
Including crypto. Crypto, you know, you might have seen some of my tweets. I don't like crypto at all. I don't understand it. I think blockchain has a future for payments. But I see Bitcoin being like the Betamax of cryptocurrencies. So I wouldn't touch that. And I guess I wouldn't touch smaller companies that have low revenue or a pre-revenue. Now, I do invest in early stage EIS companies, But I do that privately through a particular firm, and they've got a good track record. I might make money, I might not, I don't know. But I get them all the time from other firms, and they all seem like the best thing since sliced bread. There's one or two, obviously, platforms, I won't name them, but they raise money for early stage businesses. And I look at them, and if you didn't know otherwise, you'd think that is a fantastic idea. But by the law of averages, it won't be, and it will fail. So I don't touch those. So there'll be companies on AIM or floating on AIM where it's all hope value. And by the law of averages, they're not going to work. So it's not. It's more theme than sector, to be honest.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense totally. I mean, I've seen so many times that these story stocks just so rarely work.
I mean, a classic example is, I can't remember the name of the company, but it was a mattress in a box. Now. And I'd seen even before even before that IPO'd, I'd seen about three different business plans for people, you know, a few years ago, a mattress in a box. And the problem is, you're just selling one product, and the cost of acquisition of that customer is absolutely massive, and you can't create a customer journey because how many mattresses do you need to buy a year? How many beds do you have? I mean, it's a bit like, I don't like sofa companies. I know the sofa companies are doing well at the moment. But how many sofas can you buy? And if your sofa it starts to wear out a bit, it's not the type of thing you buy today when your energy prices are going up. Now, if your fridge breaks, you need to get it fixed, or your boiler breaks, you need to get it fit, or a new one, because you'll be freezing cold. But a sofa, you can make it last, can't you? So in terms of sectors, I'm very wary about consumer sectors because, again, our company, we've had some consumer businesses, but what I've learned over the last few years is that with business to business, it's all about the product, the service, the relationship, the pre-sale care, the aftercare, the warranty, the relationship, the strategic journey together between supplier and customer. And finally, you start talking about the price. Now, consumer items, it's all about the price and the weather. And people, management teams seem to be surprised that it's hot in summer and it's cold in winter. And they're kind of surprised about when Christmas comes. Now, I know Easter, I have no idea when Easter is because it changes all the time. But there's so many retail management teams who blame this, that, and the other. There's only so many days in this month, or there was an extra holiday, or the Queen died, this happened, that happened. And it's all about the weather. And there's so little differentiation. The biggest deflationary thing in our lifetime has been the internet. Because if you want to buy something, you go on the internet. And as long as it's the same product, you'll buy it. As long as you can trust the website, you'll just go for the cheapest price, won't you? But in business to business, you've got to make sure that product works. Otherwise, a plane could fall out of the sky, and people won't switch suppliers once you've got the customer. So I don't like consumer businesses, and I've been burnt before on consumer businesses.
So if you were to do a consumer business, like a retail business, what tend to be the better ones? Is it the ones that are more specialist, that really have something quite special? Is that the better ones?
I'm trying to come up with an example of something that I would like. I mean, I'm thinking
hotel chocolate as a specialist. Is that the kind of thing? Because it's special.
I just think it's a bit.
No, you're saying that one because that's the one that Pete holds. That's why he's.
It's a brand, but I just, at the end of the day, it's chocolate. And what, so you might buy somebody some hotel chocolate stuff for the birthday, and that's great, but you're not going to do it the next time. That's all. It's very faddy. I don't like Pugchay. I like Wetherspoons, actually. Not to go in, although it's fine. But I don't like trendy restaurant rollouts or bar because people want something new. And once you've been, you want to go somewhere else. So they're forever reinventing themselves. The only type of consumer type business I like the supermarkets because you've got to eat.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And I know people are saying, yeah, we've got Aldi and Lidl and that's taking some market share. I get all that. But I do like luxury goods in terms of somebody was talking about Burberry. Burberry's a classic one. Gucci, And Louis Vuitton, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think the prices are absolutely ridiculous, and I can't believe anyone would buy that type of stuff. But the point is, there's always money at the top end of the market. So, you know, Bentley's a great brand. I'm surprised Aston Martin didn't do that well. Porsche will probably do it. There's always money up there. There's the bottom end will always, Primark will always do well because people need clothes. It's the middle that'll be squeezed. And there's only people like Next who've managed to reinvent themselves several times who've done particularly well. And M&S, you know, you can't knock them. They're still there. They're the perennial ones where you think, actually, they're going to struggle. But year on year, they're still there. But no, generally, don't like retail. I think most things are a bit faddy and can be copied.
What you just said is reminding me, and I think it might remind Pete, because I think he did the same course. I did business studies at college, and I was pretty sure it was I think it was Michael Porter, wasn't it? Was that model Did you do business studies?
No, I did accountancy, but what I was doing this morning was proofreading a book that my colleague's written on Michael Porter's Five Forces. So he loves Michael Porter and Warren Buffett, and he's written books about Warren Buffett. So when we're talking about our investment style, we always say it's Michael Porter meets Warren Buffett. And I was reading this book today, and it, you know, even though I know it's so thought provoking. Mm. And if you read I'd advise any investor to read a short summary of Michael Porter's book on the Five Forces. And once you start thinking about it, it knocks out a load of things you might like, where you think, you know what, there's not much to them. And it is all about the differentiation and the price elasticity and the power of the buyers or the customers. And it's been around obviously for donkey's years, and there's nothing new in this world really in terms of how you analyze a business.
I mean I might have the name wrong, it might not have been Porter, but it was the person who said there was three strategies for attacking a market, and that was low cost, so you got to be the lowest cost operator in the sector, so that's Lidl and Aldi. Or you can be top end, the premium one. So I guess that's Waitrose and Marks and Spencer. Or you can be in the middle, which is your Sainsbury's, your Asda's, your Tesco's. And as you said, it's the ones in the middle who tend to struggle because they're getting squeezed from both sides, if you like. When there's tough times, people go down. When people feel richer, they go to M&S, you know, and it's
there's countless casualties, isn't there? Like Jules is a classic one. And, you know, that was very much middle market. And, you know, they open up and it's all trendy and it's all market towns and stuff like that. And you've never seen it before. So you buy a pair of yellow cords when you go and stuff like that. Not that way, yellow cords. or whatever. But then, you know, the novelty wears off and they've got so, you know, the cost base is massive in terms of the lease and the warehouse and the this, that and the other. I'm not really, I mean, I don't invest in tech personally because I don't understand it, but I do through these EIS guys because they purport to understand it, albeit at the end of the day, I think it's, you know, look as much as judgment. But the businesses we invest in personally, I mean, one imports screws and nuts and bolts. One makes caster wheels that go on the bottom of trolleys and things like that. Another one makes automotive cable. Another one makes sealant that goes into car engines. Another one mixes chemicals and they go into products that we understand and use. So you're halfway there if you actually understand the product and use the product.
And it's all boring stuff, isn't it?
It's all boring stuff. Absolutely.
One of the things with tech is tech's always so exciting. Crypto, blockchain, it's so exciting. Yeah. The metaverse, it's so exciting. And often exciting things are the worst possible investments.
Yeah, I mean, metaverse, I do believe it will be the future. I think it may take some time, but I think there will be some parallel universe that loads. I'm not saying it'll be good for society, but I think a lot of people will submerge themselves in the metaverse, and that gives you loads of advertising income then because you're in this room and there's things flashing up. So I can see that happening.
I've got to tell you about this thing I caught this week. There's some hotel chain. Can't remember which one it is. Some hotel, might be Marriott or something, has opened some top-end rooms in London in a special new venture. £1,500 a night for a room, right? And what it is, it's basically set up for gaming. So you book in there, and it's got all the seats for gaming and access to every single game you can imagine. And it's all geared up for gamers. And you think, that's bonkers. And they've been doing it about a month, and it is booming. They're filled up for months to come, and they're thinking of rolling it out all around the world, this concept.
Yeah, well,
that's
yeah,
mad, isn't it?
Something in the market where there's lots of money and people can have a specialist. There are always opportunities. Now, I want to shake things up a little bit and talk about, you've talked about companies doing extremely well, and then there's others like Jewels that haven't done so well. And there's a current, I'm going to read this as I've grabbed it today. A company that's got absolutely walloped recently, and they came out this morning with a rebuttal to a bear short from Viceroy Research. I'm not sure you've seen it all, and that's happening over the last couple of weeks. Home REIT. Has anyone seen the news on Home REIT and what's been going on with that? Have you seen it, Craig?
No, I don't know the detail.
Yeah. So these are not my words. So the people that usually just come to attack me all the time will just listen to this. These aren't my words. So a war of words between Home REIT and short seller Viceroy Research has erupted further today as a social housing investor looks to shake off accusations that its charity tenants are unable to meet their rent. Viceroy, which is one of the first firms to raise alarm on now collapsed Germany payments firm Wirecard. So Viceroy got form and spotting things going wrong. Yeah. Last week slammed the FTSE 250 investor Home REITs with accusations that its tenants cannot afford rent. It's meant to be a boring REIT, this, remember, guys, and are not paying or are run by bad actors. In a statement this morning, Home REIT hit back at the allegations and said that Viceroy's claims were baseless and misleading and told the firm to discontinue their campaign in the media. Addressing accusations that its tenants are not paying up, Home REIT chief said that its rents is ultimately supported by the central government funding and local authorities' statutory duty to house homeless people. Home REIT is completely confident in the integrity of the business it is operating, its financial soundness, and the beneficial impact of the company is having in reducing homelessness in the UK, the firm said. Statements published by the firm, which leases properties to charities providing social housing, claimed it had received 36 million of 36.6 million rent owed across its portfolio. However, Viceroy hit back at the defence this afternoon and said suggestion that its rents is backed by the government funding is unfounded. The illusion that Home REIT's rents is somehow government-backed is completely falsified by the bankruptcy administration of one of its major clients, Circle Housing and Support, Viceroy said. Circle Housing and Support entered into administration in July this year, and the firm states it on its website. Viceroy partner Fraser Perring said on Twitter that he submitted more complaints to the Met Police and is poised to file complaints to the FCA. He claimed that Viceroy was rejected access to a webcast call for investors today. So this is what's happened today on the shares, right? On Tuesday, Home REIT shares were at 55.8 pence on the 29th. This morning, they opened after they put out their rebuttal. 8 o'clock, whoosh, straight out the traps. The shares opened at 59.9 pence each, right? So the shares are up a good 6 or 7% from the open, 10% from the open nearly. And they actually climbed in early morning up to 61.6 pence. Viceroy then came out and attacked the rebuttal from Home REIT, and the shares went from 61.6 pence all the way down to 45.95 pence, fell 26.5% from the intraday high down to 45, ended up closing at 50.6 pence. Yeah. So this, I mean, I've said this before to everybody, and I'll repeat it again, that when shorters attack, it doesn't mean that the bears are right. It doesn't mean that they're wrong. And this is why it's so important for everybody, and I mean everybody, to research, because the devil's in the details regarding these stocks and any stock or any fund or any REIT, to read it. Don't just read the headline. Oh, they rebutted this now this morning and it's all right. I'm going in. at 1 minute past eight and buying it at 60 pence, which is what most people would have bought it at. And within 3 or 4 hours, or by this afternoon, the shares were nearly at 46 pence. So that's a good 20% fall, 25% fall in a couple of hours. So if you bought a couple of grand's worth of that, you're down several hundred pounds in a heartbeat, right? So that war of words is going to continue. The NAV, and you can qualify this as well, Craig, the NAV is still saying it's £1.11, 0.2 pence, right? So £1.11.2. I think that NAV is meaningless right now. Yeah?
Right. Yeah.
Until it's proven otherwise that everything's intact and everything's kosher with REIT, the 50% discount on the shares is meaningless. Mm. I'm not sure what your thoughts are, guys.
Well, there's a couple of things that hit me about it. First of all, it's got a similar sort of model to Triple Point Social Housing, SOHO, and to Civitas Social Housing, CSH. Both of those had issues a year or two ago. And I certainly remember reading Chunks and Investors Chronicles, you know, talking about the issues they were having. And there were all these things about, you know, providers of care homes and stuff going bust and whatever. And so in a way, we had warnings, you know. When you get a problem in a sector with a certain company, you've got to think, well, other companies in the sector could be in a similar sort of situation. I always think that. The other really weird thing about home, which gets me, is that the CFO is Lynn Fenner, and she did a brilliant job at sorting out Empiric Student Property, which I hold, ESP. She did brilliant, and I am astonished that she's got herself into this situation. So maybe she's right. I've no idea.
We don't know yet. Any thoughts, Craig?
Well, generally, another theme I don't like is where businesses are susceptible to government legislation change. So where there's either subsidies or the funding actually comes from the government. Now, so on the plus side, you'd think, well, if the rents were effectively backed up by the government in terms of the government pay the rents on behalf of the homeless people, then that's great. But if you're susceptible to the next chancellor saying, right, we're cutting that income and it's going some other route and we're going to house them somewhere else. Mm. So yeah. I've got no specific thoughts about that one, other than I did look at buying it generally with quite a few other REITs that I did for my wife. Now, just going back to the REITs I bought for her, I bought earlier in the year, I bought Ebox, and Ebox was down 40%. Yeah. And now it's down 35%. And I also bought, because I thought, you know, European warehousing, storage. Amazon, all that, sod's law, as soon as I did it, the market collapsed. But I invest in a load of other REITs as well that have done really well. So overall, I'm down ever so slightly. But if I'd put it all in Ebox, I would have been, well, divorced. Whereas actually, I've got another chance now because I've got this diversified portfolio. But the thing is to not go large into anything.
Diversify even the diversification. Agreed.
Yeah, but you look at home, and it was at sort of net asset value. It was a pound something up until recently, and obviously it has collapsed because of that short seller. And it might be a good gamble for a few quid to see if it recovers. But it's a brave man that. And as I said, you'd like to think that it contradicts what I said about the market having perfect information, because clearly the market hasn't got perfect information with this one, because the management team is saying one thing and the short seller is saying another, and only time will tell.
Only time will tell. I think the important thing here is what you've touched on there as well, is that the chancellor could change things, but also I'm in the charity sector. I'm an ambassador for one. I'm working with loads of different ones and trying to help them to raise money. And they're all screaming how hard it is this year to raise money and to maintain the services that they're putting together. Charities are really struggling. So if you've got a building which is owned or run by a charity that's dealing with the homeless, and they struggle, and financially they go, we can't cope. You know, they're bench pressing their costings and all the rest of it. Heating these buildings have gone through the sky. Some of these charities could go under, you know, and that could impact. I think it's the ticker symbol Soho, bizarrely for one of them that Pete mentioned. Yeah. So you could have a situation for home rate where, you know, their provisions of care are not sustainable, you know. So this question is there. But I'm hoping, for the sake of shareholders, that, you know, that home survived and the bears are proven wrong, because there's people were buying it this morning at 60 pence. It's finished at 50 pence-ish. And, you know, not so long ago, it was a pound. So let's just wait and see. But there could be domino effects if these bears are proven right. I think there could be a domino effect in the sector.
Yeah, I guess one of the things about Home as well is it's not been a listed company that long. I think with any of my, well, really, I think in general, in most things, I like to buy stocks of companies that have been on the market for some time, you know, 3, 4, 5 years kind of thing as a minimum. And I think, you know, Home, and in a way, you sort of, you see them go through the cycle and you start to learn, you know, what's good and bad about them. And these kind of problems are sort of ironed out by then. Do you know what I mean? And I think often that's, you know, worthwhile, really.
I think the other thing you've touched on there, Pete, is really important. And you've mentioned this quite a few times, and even Craig has been on here for the first time, mentioned it, about these new IPOs that came along during COVID. How many of them have come along? There's so many have come along. And a lot of them were consumer-type products. You know, you mentioned AO World with the fridges a bit earlier on.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio-enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer via ShareePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPETES. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe to ShareePad today using the TWINPETES promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit sharescope.co.uk/sharepad for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
But one of them that got mentioned, and this always makes me chuckle when I've got to mention our spirited former Prime Minister, how good old Boris came out in September just before he walked the plank and went, you know, went off to get paid £250,000 for 1 hour chats. He mentioned in September, go out and buy yourself a new £20 kettle and save yourself £10, right, on your energy bill. Your energy bill might be £3,000 or £4,000, but you'll save a tenner by buying another kettle. And I was like, oh my gosh. Anyway, we had lots of people over the, you know, past year and a bit buying into Strixgroup, the ticker symbol's Kettle, KETL, the tech company. And the shares rose and rose and flew, and lots of people were buying it last month. Lots of people commenting about it on Monday, Tuesday. Today, the shares got walloped 40% on a massive, massive profit warning. So my sympathies to all shareholders and everybody else. But this is one of the problems with going into stocks, which, as Pete touched on, hasn't got a long-term balance sheet that you and I have seen. They've been around for a little while. They've been doing what they were doing. Lots of noise, lots of people commenting about it, lots of people buying into it. But they've got to have a level of history of actually performing. They've come out, like you've said earlier, Craig, with an excuse, or we couldn't get the chips for our tech. Okay, so is there not a contingency? Is there not a strategy in case one supplier says no? You've got two or three other suppliers can say yes. And what's happened to the other bits of equipment that you've actually manufactured? And so why have they slowed down regarding the sales? So, you know, the share price has got absolutely crushed today, down 40%. So we'll see. It was very quiet on Twitter today regarding the people that owned it on Monday and Tuesday and last month. We'll see who comes out of the woodwork and talks about Kettle going forward. And it might be an opportunity because supply chain issues might be resolved, but 40% fall on one day.
Joe, it's funny because I've always quite liked Kettle, and I could easily have been caught on that very easily. So I'm sort of thankful that I wasn't. But I do sort of wonder if maybe give it a bit of time, it'll have to go into rehab, into the Priory for a while. But once it's had some time in rehab, which could be a year or two, could be a really good one, I think. But it's some way off. And I think holders who haven't bailed out already are going to have to accept that it's probably going to be quite a long time in the wilderness to sort itself out.
Yeah. Craig, did you see any private equity companies that were selling triggers for kettles in your time?
No. No, it's just very difficult to analyse what companies really do in the public arena, because people probably don't know actually what it really does. And whatever the announcements say, it sounds really good and the next best thing, and people pile in. And then suddenly, actually, they've not sold as many as they thought. Or this one seems to be a supply chain issue. But is it a supply chain issue? Or is it just convenient that it's a supply chain issue? Because the demand's not quite there. And the other thing is, I think there's a lot of companies like that, and like many others, that probably shouldn't be listed. They should be in the private arena. Because in the private arena, if it was one of our investments, we'd have a board meeting, or they'd ring us up and they'd say, we've got supply chain issues and we try and work something through. And it might impact on profits that year, but as long as it's properly funded, it's fine. You come up with a solution, you resource from somewhere else, or you have a plan B, da 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 da. And then in two years' time, it's fine. And then we sell it and it's fine. The share price, the problem with the stock market, management teams or boards of directors spend most of the time managing the share price instead of managing the business. That is the problem. The fundamental problem of the stock market.
Absolutely agree with you.
And they're sort of forced to, aren't they? Because it's like, it is all about presentation. They really don't want their share price to crater. Because the problem now for the management of Kettle is they're probably going to lose their jobs. Mm. Because of this debacle, they're probably going to lose their jobs. So, they've got to avoid that as much as they can, but it gets to a point where they've just got to own up and admit there's a problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Things happen in the private sector and it doesn't really matter because there's no share price.
Yeah. What might have done Kettle is that I think Kettle, from what I understand about it, probably had quite a well-established old business, which was basically safety cutouts for kettles. It was incredibly simple. Every kettle had to have a safety cutout. They were one of the few makers of it. So it was a very simple, old-fashioned, been doing it for years. But what happened since they listed is they've started going into lots of other areas like water filters. They just bought one of these instant, what's that instant quokka, whatever you call it, where you turn your water tap on and it's boiling water out of a normal tap. Yeah. They bought something like that. And it's, so they've sort of been doing lots of acquisitions and diversifying a bit. And I imagine that hasn't helped either. It takes their eye off the ball, doesn't it? And all that.
Yeah. Guys, going back.
Can I just mention something quickly? I need to mention this for Jason at StealthSurf on Twitter. I got something wrong on the last podcast, and I just need to make it clear. So on TPI 88, we were talking about how you measure returns, and I was under the impression that Jace at StealthSurf on Twitter measures banked profit as opposed to value of the portfolio. I'm wrong on that. He got in touch with me and said, no, that's not really the case. What he does, the bank profit is for working out his risk level, his exposures. But he still does the same as us. He looks at the value of the overall portfolio at the end of the year, whatever. So sorry about the confusion caused to anyone, and apologies to Jace, obviously.
Oh, cool. That's fine. We'll talk about returns on another podcast as well, Pete. I think we need to go back to it. Now, I'm going to share this with people again, because it took me 28 years of holding a share to cut some of it. And I've been in the markets again today for the second time. So in May, I sold some AstraZeneca shares. I'd reinvested all my dividends. I'd added on some dips, and I sold some around 105-ish in May. And I banked a 20-fold return on my AstraZeneca shares. I've done the same again today at betwixt 112.10 and 112.20, and I've sold a chunk of my AstraZeneca shares again. So it's now a 21-fold return for my investment. The reason why I've done it is because AstraZeneca's up over the 12-month period over 34%. And I'm a bit, like, cautious on it. I started the year with AstraZeneca being well over 50% of my portfolio. It's risen over 30% again. And I'm like, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen in December. I don't know what's going to happen in 2023. So I'm taking some off the table again. Other than that, there's no other reason for me to sell it. But I'm just cautious of the markets. I've been cautious. I was cautious at 6,800, right? And I've been wrong. And the market's now nearer to 7,600. I'm just taking some off the table because I don't know when or if this market, bear market rally will end. And I'm just being cautious. My portfolio year to date is up double digit figures. I'm not near my all-time high because of some of the other investments that have gone wrong this year for me. But I'm happy with what my returns are so far this year. So I'm just trying to lock that in to make sure I can go into the year with plenty of cash. I've got loads of cash always on the balance anyway. But if things go wrong next year, I'll pick up some stock. I've picked up some stocks in the past couple of weeks, which I'm building positions in, and I'll continue to do that. But it's just a cautionary thing. My losers, I've talked about some of them already. I've got some other losers I'll talk about before the year is out as well. And it's one of them. I think the markets are going to continue to be uncertain and they could go higher, but equally we could rock up tomorrow and Jeremy Hunt and you know, and others come out with some news which we just go and take a sharpie and take a breath. So we'll wait and see what happens.
Makes sense. Have we got time to just mention the backup charity?
Of course we have, yeah.
Yeah. Every year with the podcast, with the Twin Peaks podcast, we have a charity that we get behind, and listeners, you know, a lot of listeners contribute and whatever. And if anyone's listening out here and they want to say thank you to us for doing the podcast and that, give a donation to the charity. That would be fantastic. The charity we're supporting this year is the Backup Trust, which is a charity that specializes in spinal injuries. I've just got to tell you this because it's such a classic, right? I'm a wheelchair user. Yeah, I was paralyzed at chest level, which is why I know about the charity and why it's particularly dear to my heart. I was in Tesco's today. I've had a right old week of drama because on Monday I managed to lock my car keys in the boot of my car. And that cost me 120 quid to get a locksmith out. And it's taught me to get the spare key sorted, which I'm in process of. Anyway, today, because obviously that day I didn't manage to get the Tesco's. Today I managed to get the Tesco's. I'm wheeling around Tesco's. It's all going well. And I look down and I realise the axle on my wheelchair is coming out on one of the wheels. And it is sticking out like 2 inches. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that axle must be just hanging on. And I'm looking around thinking, what the hell am I going to do? And I'm looking around. And, of course, everyone in the shop is an old lady or they're like, you know. And it's like you're thinking, I don't want to give someone a back prop. Anyway, so I eventually find someone who looks strong enough and young enough that he could actually lift the heavy basket off my lap that I had because I'd filled it with loads of goodies. And then I sort of explaining to him that if we didn't do something about it soon, I'm going to be on the floor. So I managed to sort of rock the wheelchair and bang the axle back in and just about save the day. So it was a bit stressful. Anyway, that's...
You've been putting drama in your life, mate. Never a dull moment. You know,
it's ridiculous.
About going up and down the M6, Craig. Just get yourself a wheelchair and go to Aldi and Tesco's, mate.
Oh, man. I just cause chaos whenever I go anywhere. Anyway, so Backup is a charity that is very much involved in people who have spinal injuries. I had a motorcycle accident in 1998. And they do a lot of, like, you know, a lot of the thing with spinal injuries is the whole sort of psychology side and whatever, and the rehabilitation and adapting to a new way of living. And Backup do a lot of work in that area, and they do a lot of mentoring and stuff, particularly with children, which is brilliant. So to find the charity, we have a Just Giving page. So it's justgiving.com/fundraising/Twin Peaks. If you go to my Wheelie Dealer 2 website, so that's www.wheeliedealer2.weebly.com, go to the Twin Peaks Investing podcast page on there, and right at the top, there's a link that will take you to the Just Giving. We're up to, for the year, we've raised 2,529 quid from 59 supporters. And thank you to everyone who's supported, and thank you to everyone who intends to and is going to shortly, hopefully. We've got a message here from Sanjay Korea, giving us a really nice donation. Thanks, Sanjay. Thank you for all you do for investors who want to learn and progress. And your podcast is pretty good too. So thanks for that, mate. That's fantastic. I'll read out some more on the next podcast, yeah?
Cool. Now, Craig, I'm conscious that we've had you on here now for a good hour plus, and we're trying to make this shorter so people don't have to have a marathon. I didn't know if there's anything else you wanted to share or anything in your portfolio you wanted to share with our listeners, or even talk a little bit more about your strategy regarding how you go about picking these REITs for your good wife, or some of the things that you've put in your portfolio in the last 6 months, how you go about actually selecting them.
Yeah, there's a few things there. I'll keep it brief, so I don't want to bore people. Just first of all, a couple of sort of mistakes and learnings, really. You know, all I've talked about is I bought this and it's done well and da-da-da-da, but I bought RBS in 2007 and learned what a falling knife was. Kept buying it and lost a bit of money there. Not ridiculous money, just a bit. It was quite annoying. But again, I thought it's too big to fail. It'll always come back. It's RBS. So there's a lesson learned there. You know, I've been on about big caps today, but they can go wrong. March 2020, we had that cold that was a virus called COVID. I just thought it would be over. The market fell. So what did I do? I bought EasyJet shares and British Airways shares. And I remember really stressing. We were going skiing and I was in a minibus trying to get a signal to buy more and more Lloyd shares at 55p and then 50p before they bounced back up. And obviously they haven't. They're still in the 40s. So I've got loads of Lloyd. But, you know, the dividends are great. EasyJet, not great. And British Aerospace, not great. In terms of REITs.
Have you still got EasyJet?
Yeah, have I?
I wouldn't be surprised if it got taken over.
I hope so. It's one of the... I struggle to sell at a loss. That's the... I really struggle. If I'm sat on a loss, I struggle. If I'm sat on a profit, I struggle to sell basically anything. I should get rid of all those AIM COVID ones as well. In terms of the REITs, it's really looking at the yields and what they do. Do they look fundamentally sound? Is the yield decent? And again, I mean, I follow, is it Mike Ridyard?
Yeah, Mike Ridyard, isn't it? Yeah.
And he knows his REITs. And, I don't know his background other than I follow him. And I just look at his positions. And so I had a short list that I was going to buy, and some he had quite big positions in. I thought they're the ones, and there was one or two that he didn't. So I looked into those and thought, actually, no. And again, that's about sticking to what you know. And I thought, he knows about them. I don't. So why do you just take all the information available? And as I said, there's some really good people on Twitter to follow to get some ideas. And it's thought provoking. And we know there's people on there ramping little stocks and stuff like that. And we know who they are. But generally, people are there just to help. The other thing as well, Warren Buffett, I think, has said that when he dies, he wants all his wealth put in the S&P 500. And I think, well, actually, there's some merit in that. So what does that mean? It means it's hard to beat the market, although he has. But again, you know, my advice to younger people is just, and again, this is really boring. Everybody's heard it before. It's invest as much as you can, as soon as you can. Pound cost average in. Let it compound over the years. Make sure it's in an ISA, so you've got a bit of a tax shelter. Because there's no downside. You can get it out instantly. And just keep adding to it, and try not to touch it. And if you need to take the money out, you can take it out, but, you know, try not to. So I think people spend far too long trying to decide what to invest in rather than when and how much, because trying to get returns on a small amount of money in a short space of time is difficult. But if you've got a small amount of money and it builds up over time and compounding will make you as wealthy as you want to be.
Oh, absolutely. Can I just add that... Mike Ridyard is, oh, damn, I had it up then. Let me just find it a second.
He's on Twitter at Ridyard Mike.
Yeah, R-I-D-Y-A-R-D Mike, at Ridyard Mike. Well worth following.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I think the thing about the compounding bit, and Pete and I talk about this quite a lot, is that if you can find a good enough investment, whether it be a REIT or otherwise, and it actually pays even a slender bit of dividend, because a lot of the American stocks and funds don't pay very little dividend at all. And ours on average will pay 3 or 4%. You only then need another 6% capital gain, and you then got 10% return each year. Compound 10% a year, you know, straight away, every 7.2 years, you've doubled your money. You know, you can do it very lazily and very, very easily and very slowly. And you can outdo the market, I think, or the average investor by just trying to get 7 to 10% a year. A lot of people trying to get a home run every year and get 100% return on them on their portfolios, and they haven't. And we've seen, you've touched on it several times, Craig, today, you know, the number of people that are in small cap AIM stocks, they've been battered over the last 18 months. They've been absolutely smashed to ribbons. And the, you know, I see even traders now, 95% cash, 100% cash. I mean, they're just sitting there waiting for the markets to go belly up, to go back into the market. And you know, you're saying you're staying reasonably fully invested, or doing something similar to that. So there's a lot of people right now that are sitting and don't want to be in the market.
Their portfolio
has been hit. You know,
absolutely. I mean, somebody put a graph on and said, if you missed the 10 worst trading days, you'll have made this much money over the last few years. And I replied and said, well, if I was you, I would have just put it on the lottery, because clearly, if you know which 10 days to avoid, you may as well just put your money on the lottery.
If you missed the worst days, you've made that much. But what if you missed the 10 best days?
Yeah, no, you absolutely. Know,
that's the other argument to it.
I think it's linked to what you guys were saying. I think one of the number one rules of investing is you've got to at least capture the market return.
Yeah.
If you're not managing to do, you know, 7-8% a year on average over time, then all your mucking around and fiddling around really is a waste of time,
especially with fees and spread.
It
hits your returns,
and the effort obviously and all the rest of it, you know. And it's, and the trouble is, it's like, yeah, you can have some good years where you're making 20-40%, but it just takes one year like this year where you're down 60%, and all that good work has just been chucked away, you know. It's but capturing it's almost like you've got to focus first at getting the market gain, and then what you're trying to achieve is a bit more than that. 2-4% more than that really makes big money. But even if you just capture the market gain, you do really well and you make a lot of money
over time. Yeah, we've got that massive advantage. We don't, you know, we can do what we want. We don't have to sell when other people say you should sell.
I mean, I really envy young people listening to this podcast, and I'm talking anyone, you know, 40 and under, I guess. You know, it's like if people of that under 40 who can listen, who can build on what's being said from so many great investing people that give their information, give their help and their guidance, you know, freely. If they can just pick up the key bits from that and just get it right with all that time, they're just going to be absolutely loaded by the time they get to our age. They'll be absolutely minted.
Yeah.
We spoke about it a couple of times. We were saying last time, you know, compounding that kind of money over 40 years in your 20s to 65, you're going to make yourself nine million quid if you do it the right way, just with 10%. So
I think, like, can I just say, when I started investing and I was sort of probably at 33, 34, it was like there just weren't the kind of resources there are today. It just wasn't there. You know, you had...
I think the problem, Pete, for a majority of investors using Twitter, using social media, using, you know, all different WhatsApp groups, they've actually got too much information.
Yeah.
Right? And they've got this supercomputer in their pocket going, beep, 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 with lots of new notifications all the time. So they're actually churning and churning and trading and buying and stop slicing relentlessly, you know, week in, month out, year out, far too much. Instead of picking a core number of, you know, like Craig has said, you know, funds, ETFs, REITs, and going, right, I'm done now. I'm going to sit and stay invested. Or every now and then when the market and the cycle changes, I might tweak it a little bit. But some people are just going through the whole of portfolio and starting all over again. Or they've gone all in cash and sitting on the sidelines.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. Guys, I'm conscious of the time. I'm just going to throw one thing last thing out there.
Yeah.
Mentioned it before. I'll mention it again. I'm still supporting, and I will be supporting ongoing, Memphis. We've got the Christmas list out, ladies and gents. We're looking to provide 1,500 presents for children in and around Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland. And I'm looking to for all of you, if possible, to make a little donation. Each present we're going to buy is going to come to a value of about £15. So we're looking to raise £22,500 between now and the beginning of or the middle of December to get these 1,500 presents. And then I'll be going out and other people will be delivering them. And we're going to have a specialist grotto as well, where we're going to deliver some presents to some kids as well. So I'm looking for donations as best you can to just go onto the Just Giving page for Memphis, which is www.justgiving.com/Memphis, M-E-N-P-H-Y-S, Christmas list 2022. Yeah, so 2022 is what I'm looking for you guys to just go to, ladies and gents, and make a donation to that. Make some kids really happy this Christmas so we can go and just drop some presents off and help those that are disadvantaged or won't get in a Christmas present at all, or, you know, something suitable this Christmas. So if you can and support that for me, I'll be really, really chuffed. So that's all I'm asking for you guys to do. Craig, any thoughts? And thank you again for coming on.
No, thank you for inviting me. You know, I think you two guys are awesome. The time and effort you put into these podcasts and the help you give and just the style of it. There's some other podcasts and they just give out information and you just turn off. But I always look forward to your podcast. But unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to listen to this one because it's me. So I'll have to wait until the next one.
That is going to be so weird.
Get the boss to listen to it, mate. Get the wife to listen to it and she'll tell you if you're really good. So, you know what I mean?
I hate it. It's like I've started doing these TikTok videos and every time I have to watch myself do that, I just hate it. It's like, oh my God, it's horrendous. Oh dear.
No, mate, it's an absolute delight to have you on. Thank you for your support on Twitter as well. There'll be loads and loads of feedback, mate, and lots of people are going to be pipping you and following you on Twitter once they listen to your odes of wisdom from your experiences and beauty of it is as well, you've shared your mistakes, you've shared some of your learning. You know, there's far too many people that we know of that are on social media that know it all already. Pete and I don't, right? Warren Buffett's still learning, still making mistakes. You know, and you've got the skill of being an accountant. You know, everyone's saying, oh, if you want to know a company, you've got to know the balance sheet. How many people have got that skill, you know, to be an accountant, be able to look at the minutiae of the details of the balance sheet? So that's really, really good that you've come on here and shared some of your knowledge and intellect with us. And I appreciate that. So we will see you again soon. Ladies and gents, thank you ever so much for joining Willie and I on Twin Peaks Investing number 89. We'll celebrate number 90 in 2 weeks' time. I'm really, really, really pleased that you will get to hear from the secret accountant on Twitter. He won't be listening, but please do listen to us. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks and keep bringing your feedback to us. And we'll look forward to hearing from you. Until then, stay safe. And if you see anybody in the wheelchair in Tesco's or Aldi, look out, because this, you know, the wheels might be coming off Wheelie's chair. Take care, people. God bless you all.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. See ya. Thanks, Craig.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with Sharepad from Sharescoop, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit sharescoop.co.uk and discover the advantage.